Imagine this. You arrive in Vietnam, you're ready for your tour, and pretty much the first thing you hear is that a recon team, Spike Team Idaho, just vanished, gone, right after arriving.
Yeah, it's a stark opening, isn't it? And that unsettling reality is central to the listener's source material for this deep dive, specifically the YouTube video, Episode 2, Secret War Revealed, SOG's Deadliest Vietnam Missions.
Exactly. The video really pulls back the curtain, just a bit, on MACV SOG. That's the Military Assistance Command Vietnam Studies and Observations Group. Sounds mundane, right?
Deceptively so, because what this episode reveals through these intense firsthand accounts from the veterans themselves is this incredibly dangerous clandestine world, a secret war the public knew almost nothing about.
So that's our focus today. We're diving deep into this specific video, pulling out the core experiences shared by these veterans. We want to get a handle on why this secret war even existed, the extreme risks.
And the sheer bravery involved. I mean,
Yeah.
day-to-day survival required extraordinary acts.
Yeah.
Our goal here is to really unpack the realities presented in that episode.
Okay, so let's start with the basics. MACV SOG. Why did it exist? The video touches on this treaty, right? 1962.
Right. That treaty was supposed to guarantee the neutrality of Cambodia and Laos, meaning no foreign combat troops. But North Vietnam didn't exactly play by those rules.
They kept using the Ho Chi Minh Trail, running right through those countries.
Absolutely. It was a
Wow.
critical supply line. The
Yeah.
video makes it clear this was happening constantly. So the U.S. faced a dilemma. How do you counter that activity without overtly breaking the treaty yourself?
Enter SOG. Established in 64, as the veterans in this episode recount, their job was basically to go where others couldn't, wasn't it?
Precisely. Reconnaissance,
Yeah.
intelligence gathering, finding out what the enemy was doing in these supposedly off-limit zones. Codenames Prairie Fire for Laos, Daniel Boone for Cambodia.
And you need to grasp, this wasn't like regular army stuff. They were deep behind enemy lines. Officially, they weren't even there.
Which amplified the danger enormously. If something went wrong, and it often did, getting help, getting extracted, it was incredibly complicated. No front lines here.
The way they even recruited people speaks volumes, doesn't it? The video describes sergeants just quietly asking for volunteers after in-country training. No details.
Just need volunteers for a special project.
Yeah.
Imagine signing up for that. It tells you something about the mindset, maybe the sense of duty these guys had, stepping into the complete unknown.
And then the secrecy really ramped up. They take you into a room, tell you to put away notes, and hand you a document.
Sign this first, then we'll tell you more. And that document, as the vets describe it in the episode, a 20-year vow of silence.
20 years under threat of federal prosecution if you talked about this secret war.
It sounds extreme, but you have to remember the political stakes. Getting caught operating in neutral countries, it could have blown up into a much bigger international incident.
Yeah.
The secrecy was paramount.
And it wasn't just a signature. One vet tells the story, it's kind of amazing, about government guys collecting his trash years after he got back.
Yeah, picking through his garbage. Just to make sure nothing slipped out, it shows how seriously top secret was taken. It wasn't just a mission, it was a lifelong burden of silence, really.
So the danger, it wasn't abstract. The speaker in the video talks about arriving at FOB1, Forward Operating Base 1, and immediately hearing about Spike Team Idaho.
Glen Lane, Robert Owen, four indigenous troops flew out just before the speaker arrived. And then, nothing. Radio silence vanished.
What an introduction, right? It just hangs there. This immediate unexplained loss sets a terrifying
It
tone.
really underscores the unpredictability. You just disappear out there, no trace. A constant theme in these accounts.
And then just days later, they launch a bright light mission to find them. Now, you need to understand, bright light wasn't just a search party.
No. These were incredibly dangerous missions in themselves, going into potentially hostile territory, likely where the team was lost, looking for survivors or remains. High chance of contact.
Patrol Mike Tucker went in. They got shot up badly, lost a South Vietnamese soldier they couldn't even recover. Intense fight. Still no sign of Spike Team Idaho.
And that failed mission early on highlights another grim reality. Trying to recover the lost often led to more losses. It foreshadows the casualty rates.
Which were just astronomical. The speaker in the video flat out says casualty rates for Green Berets operating across the fence were 100%.
Or greater.
Greater than 100%. Think about that. It means guys were getting wounded multiple times. It wasn't if you got hit, it was when and how many times.
Sergeant Howard mentioned in the episode eight Purple Hearts. Eight. And he apparently refused three others.
And a Medal of Honor. For a mission in Prairie Fire 1968, his record just screams constant extreme danger, almost unimaginable.
Those first days at FOB-1, the video paints a brutal picture. Three or four teams, right after the speaker arrived, were just gone, wiped out or vanished.
Except for one team leader, John Allen. He managed to evade and escape after a week alone. But think about that initial attrition rate. It tells you the NVA knew they were coming, right? They had good intelligence, good defenses set up. New teams were walking into traps.
Immense pressure from the moment they hit the ground. And remember, as the vets emphasize in this episode, once they were across the fence, they were utterly alone on the ground.
No Marines coming, no Army infantry backup, nothing.
Their only lifeline, their absolute connection to survival, was the air. Air Force, Army gunships, the SPATs, as they called airborne support.
Imagine being surrounded miles inside enemy territory. The only hope you have is the sound of those engines. You can see why they felt such a bond with the pilots.
Absolutely. There's a bit in the video where the speaker admits they initially misidentified the A1E Sky Raiders, just call them A1s, but they learned fast.
Why were the Sky Raiders, the Sandys, so vital?
They were rugged, propeller-driven planes, not jets. They could fly low and slow, loiter over a target for a long time, and deliver really accurate fire. Perfect for close air support when a team was pinned down. The respect for those pilots just radiates from the accounts.
Okay, let's get into one of those specific missions, the video details. October 5th, 1968. A nine-man recon team.
Yeah, this one sounds bad from the start. Led by an inexperienced team leader, they apparently walked right into a prepared L-shaped ambush. The NVA knew they were coming.
Which tells you, experience was everything out there, doesn't it? One bad call.
Catastrophic consequences. And it shows how good the enemy could be at using the terrain, setting traps, a constant worry for SOG teams.
The firefight that followed, according to the veteran, lasted all day. All day.
Intense. They lost helicopters trying to help. A King Bee, a Jolly Green Giant, even the gunships, the muskets, took heavy damage. One ran out of ammo.
That's how fierce it was. And the team on the ground, right. They started running out of ammunition themselves.
So they did something incredible. Desperate, really. The video describes them picking up enemy weapons, AK-47s, RPGs, using captured ammo, even stacking enemy bodies for cover.
Survival mode, whatever it takes.
Pure desperation and amazing resourcefulness under fire.
And then comes this moment of sheer heroism from the air. An A-1 pilot callsign executioner, Dan Cook.
Right. The vet recounts another NVA wave charging their position. Cook flies his Sky Raider directly between the team and the charging enemy, low, exposing himself completely.
And just mows them down, saved the team. What does that tell you?
Incredible courage, deliberately putting your aircraft, your life, on the line like that. It speaks volumes about the bond, the mutual reliance between ground teams and air support. They knew the pilots would risk everything.
And the veteran telling this story, he gets emotional. He mentions that the pilot executioner was actually being buried the day they recorded the video.
Wow. That hits hard. It makes it so personal, doesn't it?
Ah.
Reminds you, these weren't just call signs. They were real people losing comrades who'd save their lives. The human cost is right there.
Even the extraction wasn't safe. They're being lifted out by a King Bee, and the supporting aircraft are firing so close.
That spent shell casings are raining down, hitting the speaker, burning him.
Yeah. Just imagine that chaos. Friendly fire, even just casings, is a hazard during the escape. Razor-thin margins everywhere.
Constantly living on the edge, every single phase of the mission.
Now, this ambush story takes another twist years later. Lynn Black, who was on that team.
He gets a phone call. Out of the blue.
From the North Vietnamese general who commanded the ambush against them.
No way! That's unbelievable. What did he say?
The general remembered Lin, said Lin shot him three times right at the start, watched his own men get killed, but then he drops this bombshell.
What was it?
Intelligence-wise, Lin's team thought they'd maybe hit a battalion headquarters, a significant target. The general tells him, no, you hit the division headquarters.
A whole division HQ.
And inflicted 90% casualties on it. That tiny nine-man team pinned down, fighting for their lives. They'd unknowingly crippled a major enemy command center.
Wow. That's astonishing. It shows the disproportionate impact these small teams could have, especially with that air support, even when they didn't realize it themselves.
Exactly. The fog of war, right? They had no idea at the time. Incredible validation years later from the enemy commander himself.
Okay, the video then shifts focus a bit to bright light missions. We mentioned them before.
Right, the recovery missions. Downed airmen remains. George Hunt shares a story from August 68. Why were these considered so deadly?
Well, think about it. You're going directly to a known crash site or the last known location of missing guys. The enemy knows this too. It's often bait for an ambush or heavily defended, extremely high risk.
George's mission was to recover a pilot, Wayne Wolf Kyle. He'd been shot down trying to support George's own team earlier.
And this wasn't the first attempt. Two previous Bright Light teams had tried to get to that crash site and got shot out, forced emergency extractions.
So George's team knew they were heading into a hornet's nest. The terrain was bad, too.
So George, who trained his indigenous troops in rappelling, decided on a risky insertion. Rappel down the mountain to the site.
But the ropes weren't long enough at first. They had to improvise right there.
Shows that adaptability again, doesn't it? Thinking on your feet in extreme danger. They eventually got inserted elsewhere and had to fight their way towards the wreckage, constantly pursued.
And the orders. Grimm doesn't cover it. Bring back anything with numbers. If you can't get the body, bring back the hands.
Yeah, it's brutal. But identification was paramount, providing some kind of closure. However grim the method, it highlights the terrible reality they dealt with.
At the site, they find pieces of the plane, a char flight helmet. That's it. George carries that uncertainty for decades. Did we get enough? Was he identified?
Had that burden, you know. Did my mission, the risk we took, actually achieve its purpose? It clearly weighed on him.
So years later, he tries to find out. Through some connections, a writer helps.
And they find a newspaper article.
Yeah, an article where Wayne Wolf Kyle's son says the only thing the family ever knew was that a charred helmet was recovered.
Oh, wow. So George finds out after 40 years that, yes, what they did mattered. It gave the family something. That must have been immense relief.
Huge closure. And then, incredibly, just 2 years before this video was recorded, George actually met Wayne Wolf Kyle's family at a special ops reunion.
That's powerful. Yeah. Connecting after all that time, it really shows the lasting impact, the bonds, the need for remembrance.
But the video stresses again. Bright lights were often the deadliest. Lynn Black was on another one September 69 with a French volunteer.
Direct insertion into a hot crash site. Bodies literally embedded in the dashboard.
Recovering them under fire. Extracted on ropes. An A1 doing a gun run practically on top of them. Just insane risk levels.
It paints a picture of almost suicidal bravery, really. The commitment to leave no one behind, no matter the cost.
Another story that stands out in the episode. Oshawa Valley, August 3rd. Six-man team. Overrun.
Team leader Pete Boggs makes that impossible call. Airstrike on his own position. Keenger Close doesn't begin to describe it.
It's the absolute last resort, isn't it? Means you're about to be wiped out.
Exactly. Radio operator Tom Cunningham gets hit badly by a 20-millimeter round from that friendly fire, has an out-of-body experience. John Walton is trying desperately to save him.
They somehow get extracted by King Bees, South Vietnamese pilots flying those old H-34s under heavy fire. The video shows bullet holes stitched across the helicopter.
Tangible proof of the danger. But Cunningham survived, lived a full life, amazing resilience. His survival, the state of that chopper, it underscores the chaos, the risk for everyone involved, air crews included.
The deep dive also gives us glimpses of life off mission, back at FOB-1, Phu Bai, and other bases mentioned.
Yeah, it's not all high-octane combat. There's the day-to-day reality, working with the indigenous troops, the little people, as they call them.
The constant background hum of danger, though, minefields around the base, occasional mortar attacks, you couldn't fully relax.
And the importance of those King Bee helicopters, not just for combat, but just getting around. The speaker mentions a funny first flight experience.
Their main weapon, the CR-15. The insertion technique spiraling down in auto-rotation. Crazy stuff.
And the reliance on everyone. Counterparts, door gunners, spotting threats. Like that tripwire attached to a 500-pound bomb they nearly flew into.
Jeez. Disaster averted by sharp eyes. The video mentions team rooms. A green beret lounge trying to maintain some normalcy.
A medical dispensary. The attached helicopter unit. The muskets, even a football game anecdote. These details matter. They humanize the experience.
There's mention of a medic, Black Label Perry, camp defenses like 50 cals, trench lines, a funny story about a mamasan stealing underwear, night ambushes around the perimeter, officers' quarters.
Unique characters, too. Spider Parks, known for throwing things accurately. An NVA soldier nicknamed Cowboy.
And more harrowing moments, like Henry King saving the speaker during a rappelling mishap on extraction.
Shows that absolute reliance on your teammates. Trust was everything.
The video also touches on how they handled guys who weren't cutting it on missions.
Yeah, it wasn't formal discipline usually. More internal chats, moving someone to a less critical role. Quiet transfers. A voluntary assignment, after all. You could step down, request something else.
Protecting the team was paramount. Then there's the coordination piece, the Covey pilots.
Crucial role. Air Force pilots in O2 observation planes with a Green Beret controller in the backseat. They were the air traffic control for combat.
Directing everything. Fast jets, those Sky Raiders, Marine gunships like Cobras.
Yeah, orchestrating all that firepower to support the guys on the ground. The video mentions early Cobras sometimes struggled to even get airborne, interestingly.
And that point about inter-service rivalry disappeared across the fence.
When you're fighting for your life together, Army, Air Force, Marines, it didn't matter. It was just us. Survival trumps everything.
Things shifted around 69, didn't they? SOG units consolidated, Kisan closed, new FOBs opened.
Right. FOB 1 became CCC, Command and Control Central. FOBs 5 and 6 consolidated down south, adapting to the war's changes. The video mentions the 20th Special Ops Squadron, the Green Hornets, flying slicks down south, too.
Then there's a mission in Cambodia. Intelligence reports 3 NVA divisions missing. Maybe 30,000 men?
Huge force. And they had these surprisingly good recon photos from 68 showing major enemy infrastructure in Cambodia where they weren't supposed to be.
The Green Hornets insert a team into a base camp that looks recently abandoned.
Only to run smack into elements of 2 of those missing divisions moving in. Talk about bad timing.
Had to beat a hasty retreat. Claymore mines, desperate extraction. And the speaker notes, no A1s in Cambodia, just gunships with miniguns.
Different theater, different assets available, relying on that high volume of fire from the miniguns instead of the loitering Sky Raiders.
Okay, finally, the video covers Operation Tailwind. Deep into Laos, 1970.
Yeah, this was unprecedented. The political situation in Cambodia was shifting, NVA pushing hard. The CIA's own secret war in Laos was under pressure.
So they call in SOG, specifically a hatchet force from CCC Kanto.
Right. Captain Gene McCauley leading 16 Green Berets, Mike Rose is the medic, and 120 indigenous troops. Their mission, penetrate deeper into Laos than ever before, basically create a diversion.
Draw heat away from the CIA's operations, huge risk.
Immediate contact, first night. B-40 rocket hits, wounds McCauley and the medic, Mike Rose.
And Rose, despite serious wounds, foot nearly severed by the shrapnel, he keeps going. Keeps treating others, marches for 4 days like that.
Unbelievable toughness and dedication. The video highlights they had great air cover, A1s, Cobras, FACs, Spectre gunships, but constant night attacks.
Extraction plan for day 3, using big Marine CH-53 Deltas because they were so deep in.
But it turns into a nightmare. Helos take fire coming in. One CH-53 tries to pick up the worst wounded, gets hit, aborts, then crashes back at the landing zone.
Disaster. Leads to that dramatic ladder extraction under fire. There's even an iconic photo of it.
And it gets worse. Another B-40 hits the main extraction Helos fuel tank. It limps off.
And crashes right into NVA positions a short distance away.
Just absolute chaos. While all this is happening, the team on the ground is destroying enemy supplies. They found weapons, codes, food.
Someone even answers an NVA field telephone during the firefight. Surreal.
Sky Raiders are dropping CS gas to try and suppress the enemy closing in. Intense pressure during the final extraction attempt.
A soldier is killed right next to McCauley. The overloaded CH-53 takes hit after hit. Both engines fail.
Pilot does an incredible auto-rotation, a controlled crash landing near water. McCauley gets injured in the landing, but they're down, alive. Another helo comes back for the rescue.
And through all that, Mike Rose, the sole medic, wounded himself from day one, treating casualties the entire time.
His actions were finally recognized decades later. Medal of Honor, October 23rd, 2017. An incredible story of heroism from that operation.
It really brings the debate mentioned in the video to life. Who had the most dangerous job? Pilots or ground troops? The answer seems to be both.
Yeah.
Equally perilous.
Mm-hmm. It was a symbiotic relationship built on mutual extreme risk.
So wrapping up this deep dive into episode 2, Secret War Revealed, the picture is just one of intense danger, unbelievable resilience, and extraordinary courage from these MACV SOG teams.
Definitely. And that absolute dependence on air power, the bond between the ground pounders and the pilots. You really feel that comes through in the veterans' stories.
The human cost is undeniable. But stories like finally identifying Wayne Wolf Kyle or Mike Rose's Medal of Honor, they show the enduring impact, the search for closure, the recognition of sacrifice.
And connecting it back for you, the listener, what stands out is the sheer dedication of these individuals, operating in total secrecy, often against overwhelming odds, relying on their training, each other, and those air crews who risked it all.
It leaves you thinking, doesn't it, about the nature of these secret wars, the ethical questions, perhaps, and the vital importance of remembering these stories, bringing them out of the shadows after so many years of enforced silence. Something to definitely ponder.